even as we get older, parents still like to put forward some better effort. So anyway, here. Yeah, we can put it on if there's. Yeah, by all means. So in this way, there is a nice example of how there is a mixture of mellows, and sometimes they don't mix. The parental relationship doesn't really lend itself to mixing with the conjugal relationship. It's an incompatible mixture of loving dealings with Krishna. So this here, this chapter is called A Perverted Expression of Mellows. But these relationships that are existing in their eternal, in their permanent form with Krishna, when those relationships are actually practically awoken, that stayi bhava, that steady ecstasy of the particular relationship that a devotee has for Krishna, it may be mixed in with other relationships which heighten and produce a different flavor to sweeten it and to increase the flavor. Just like, for example, you may have very nice sweet rice, and if there is some camphor mixed in with it, it actually heightens and enhances the experience for a while. But still, the basic principle of sweet rice is like that. So just to give you an idea that sometimes different moods of loving, of dealings come in to the steady relationship that the devotee has in Krishna, with Krishna, either in Shantaras, neutrality, or Dasyaras, servitude to Krishna, or with fraternal love with Krishna, with friendship with Krishna, or in parental love with Krishna, or in conjugal love with Krishna. So these relationships, the devotees exist in their eternal relationships, and those relationships are gradually revealed to the devotees what is their actual eternal state of existence. But also the other relationships come in to enhance and give a little spice of life also. Like that. Okay. Any questions or comments? Anything? Is it okay?
Yes.
I hope it's a little clear. But anyway, if you have any question, please don't feel embarrassed or hesitant.
No.
You're very welcome to inquire, because the whole experience should be a learning experience and one which is beneficial also. Would you like to read us this next paragraph then, please, Prabhu?
One of the friends of Srimati Radharani told her, "My dear friend, Gandharvika Radharani, you are the most chaste girl in your village, but now you have divided yourself and are partially caste and
chaste
and partially unchaste. It is all due to Cupid's influence upon you after you saw Krishna and heard the sound of his flute. This is another example of uparasa caused by divided interest in conjugal love."
So this example is there. The description in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is that Srimati Radharani, she saw Balaramji, and she became attracted to him by his wonderful beauty. But the fact is that Balaram is also Krishna. Simply is the second body of Krishna. So though she's attracted by Balaram also, actually her real love is actually only for Krishna. So this is the example. So uparasa, if we look back to the first paragraph of this, then we see in this chapter on page 397 that there's rasabasa, which is the overlapping of mellows, or incompatible mixtures of mellows, may be classified as uparasa, false expression, which is this example of Balaram. It's not a real expression. or anurasa, imitation, and aparasa, perverted or misrepresented mellows. And sometimes these are described as being, I saw today, they're presented as being in the original verse in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, as being like uttama, madhyam, and kanishta. So first class, second class, and third class. So first class rasabhasa is these uparasa, this false expression. And imitation is the second class, and aparasa is perverted or misrepresented mellows. For example, the demons, they cannot actually have any real relationship with Krishna. It may appear to be a relationship, but we'll see an example of that a little bit later on in this paragraph when we come to the next page. Any questions or comments so far? It may be a little technical, maybe difficult to understand, but even we understand or don't understand, just we try to hear, and ultimately one day we will understand more and more. Is it okay? Okay. So Ashok Prabhu, would you like to read us the next little bit, please?
Yeah, is that according to some expert?
Yeah.
According to some expert learned scholars, the feelings between lower and beloved create perverted reflections of mellow in many ways. The gopis have become purified by Krishna's glance, and as such, Cupid's influence is distinctly visible on their bodies. Although in the material sense, the glancing of a boy at a girl is a kind of pollution, when Krishna threw his transcendental glance at the gopis, they became purified. In other words, because Krishna is the absolute truth, any action by him is transcendentally pure.
So this is a very interesting combination, because normally when young boys and girls glance at each other, this is then you see that there's the influence of Cupid, and that loving attraction is there, and this is in a material sense, and that is a kind of contamination. But here we see that the nice example is that the gopis have become purified by Krishna's glance. They haven't become contaminated by Krishna's glance. Rather, they've become purified, because Krishna is the supreme pure. This is the difference. He is the supreme pure personality of Godhead. And the result of Krishna's glancing on them is that just as if we glance on a woman and become lusty in our hearts, or a woman glances on us and we become, and some lusty feeling develops, this is a disturbance within the body, and the symptoms can be perceived. But here it's seen that the symptoms of conjugal love are visible within the bodies of the gopis because of Krishna glancing on them. And the difference, of course, between conjugal love in the any kind of loving dealings with Krishna and in the material world is that in the material world I want to satisfy my senses. But in the spiritual world, the devotee, in spiritual relationship with Krishna, the devotee thinks and feels, I want to satisfy Krishna's senses. There is no sense of personal lusty desire or lusty agitation. The difference is that pure natural urge of the soul to satisfy Krishna by loving dealings becomes awakened. And sometimes that is described in the Shastras as lusty desire. But that is a lusty desire to serve Krishna. So it is a pure, it is the original form of lusty desire, not the lusty desire that is experienced in these material bodies for another living material body. So because Krishna's body is transcendentally different from ours, we have to know the difference between what is Krishna and what is these material bodies that we find ourselves in here. Krishna's transcendental body, what is Krishna's body? What is the nature of Krishna's transcendental body? Satchidananda Vigraha. Yes, Krishna's form is the embodiment of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Therefore, it's very different from these bodies of ours. Whereas, although spiritually the jiva is a part of Krishna and is also by nature eternal, full of bliss and full of knowledge, we are now absorbed in this temporary, ignorant, miserable body. We've accepted this covering. But Krishna never accepts the covering of a material body. Krishna comes as he is, as he explains in Bhagavad Gita. He says, Ajopi sanna vyayatma bhutanam ishvaropi san. Which means?
Although I'm unborn, you know, I appear every millennium in my own transcendental bodies.
Yes, although I'm unborn, and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all sentient beings, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. Sambhavami atma maya. Krishna comes by his own potency. We cannot say the same things about ourselves, because these bodies that we've got, they are seriously deteriorating. Actually, it's a fact. We used to have very nice young bodies. Now some of us are getting old and the hair is disappearing and the teeth are disappearing. The wrinkles are coming and so many problems. The aches and pains are coming and so many different problems. But Krishna doesn't have these issues because he never accepts a material body. His form is transcendental and original. And he comes as he is. Just like when we come into the prison house, if we're arrested and go into the prison, we have to wear what they call the bracelets. yes, we put on the handcuffs and the ball and chain. We have this dress. But when the king comes into the prison house, he doesn't have to accept. Just because he's walked into the prison doesn't mean that he's under the control or under the laws of the prison. He's transcendental to the laws of the prison. Krishna never wears bracelets, these material handcuffs of this shackles of this material body. He's never affected by the material nature because it's his own nature and he's completely free to do with his own nature whatever he likes. We, because we're tiny, we become affected by material nature and we're forced to act and be controlled by the material nature. But Krishna is never touched by the material nature. Material nature cannot cover him. Rather, Krishna, he is controlling every aspect of the material nature. He's present within every atom of the material nature, and his form was the Supersoul. It's entirely working under his direction. Just like we were discussing the other day, the example of how the sun by its energy creates from the water, it creates a cloud. And that cloud is created by the sun's energy. And it may be that we may think, well, the cloud is covering the sun. But there is no possibility that a cloud can cover the sun. It can cover our vision, but it cannot possibly cover the sun. So similarly, Krishna's energy, this Krishna's inferior material nature, Krishna's describing in Bhagavad Gita, is just that. Bhumirapa nalo vayu kammano buddhirevacha ahankara itiyame bhinna prakriti rashtada. Krishna says these eightfold material energies, my separated material energies, earth, water, fire, air, ether, sky, mind, intelligence, and false ego. These eight together, these comprise my separated material energies. So these are created by Krishna and they're completely under his control. And Krishna does ever become controlled by them. But we also need to understand carefully this example, Hare Krishna Prabhu. Haribo, that the example of the original existence of everything, just like here we see the perverted forms of personalities, we see these temporary decaying material bodies born in ignorance, getting old and usually dying in ignorance. This is the material body. And this, although we can see that when the soul steps out of the material body, the body is lying on the floor. It has no actual life. It has no value. And the result is that we can see that it's not the body which is the living entity. It's only the covering, the dress of the living entity. Just the ornament But we become so much attached to this material body. We see that the person driving down the street in his car thinks, "Oh, I am this car. You know, oh, he's got a big, he's a bigger car than me. He's a Mercedes, and I'm just driving down in this little, you know, this Mazda." Mm. And whatever it may be, we have this identification with this temporary material body, and so we suffer and enjoy according to the circumstances. But actually, we have nothing to do with this dress, this outward dress of the material body. We get out of the car and we walk away. And simply we get out of this material body and we go on and we take another material body. But Krishna is not like that. The living principle is that the jiva, he is Krishna's eternal part and parcel, his little particle of Krishna. Therefore, because Krishna is all potent, the living entity is tiny and potent. And because of the potency of that jiva, who's particle of Krishna, this body acts and dances and does so many wonderful things. Otherwise, what is happening when the jiva leaves, it lies on the floor. It's a dead body and it rots and it smells of raw meat and you want to burn it or bury it as quickly as possible. So the only thing that actually makes this body alive and attractive is this little particle of Krishna, the jiva. So we should know that this is the real platform of existence, and the real relationship is with Krishna. So these expressions here, as we come to the end of this book and this chapter, are very confidential subject matters. But if we can understand this principle, that the original, the adiras, is actually with Krishna. And when we forget Krishna and come into this material world, the temporary ras is with these material bodies. But this is a perverted reflection of the original ras that is there, that is very kindly being revealed to us through the pages of Nectar of Devotion and Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and these other wonderful literatures. That's the original relationship, is with Krishna. It's spiritual forms. Because just as we've got this spiritual form, we've got this material form, why you have some cloth and you make it into the shape of a glove, it looks like a hand because it's got the hand, the living hand inside it. Why does this material body, this dead body, look like a living person? Because it's got the living person inside it. So we should know that the original form, the spiritual form, is actually the personality. And uncovering our spiritual personalities as eternal servants of the Lord, in whatever relationship ultimately it turns out to be, is the business of spiritual life. So that's what we're trying to develop. Any questions or comments? Hare Krishna.
A short question.
Yeah.
In this paragraph you read that although in the material sense the cleansing of a boy at a girl is a kind of pollution.
Mm.
Now, in this material world, is this, can we call this, or do we call this a lust, or is it love when a young boy or a girl
is lusty desire
to another young boy or a girl?
Yeah, it's lusty desire, because the principle is that I want to enjoy. My senses are making demands. I want to enjoy seeing, touching, talking, whatever. And this is actually the desire of the senses. The senses pull us, and Cupid infects us. Oh, love! But the principle is that this is actually lust. It goes under the name of love in this material world, but actually love exists in the spiritual world. Love exists on the platform of trying to satisfy Krishna's senses. But in the material world, because I'm falsely identified with this material body and I've become victimized by my sense of identifying with this material body, and I've become captivated by this material body, and I've become enslaved by my senses, I become the servant, out of ignorance of Krishna, I become the servant of the senses of this material body, instead of the servant of Krishna and his senses. It's out of forgetfulness of our relationship with Krishna, which is actually a loving relationship, that we accept the position of being agitated by desires to satisfy the senses of this material body. So that is lust.
So when we see people saying that, oh, I'm in love and this is a great feeling, this and that.
It means this is
just simply lust.
Walt Disney, he put it very nicely, and I think it was in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He said that this one has become pixelated. He's become spellbound, caught up in the spell of love, so-called loving dealings. But actually, we become caught up in the spell, because if we understand the transcendental position, what have I got to do with this temporary material body? But by the action of Cupid releasing his arrow, he uses his arrows in the form of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Our senses become agitated, and the heart becomes even more tightly bound up in the knot of material affection. And we become absorbed in more deeply in the concept of aham mameti, I'm this material body. This person is the material body. This is the real relationship. This is the real thing. This is love. But actually, this is not the real thing. This is lust. And this is Maya's victimization that convinces us that I'm this material body even more strongly, and that I belong in this material world, and that this is my partner. For how many years or seconds we can accept this partner before we're out. So this is Maya's trick to keep us in illusion in the material world. So this is the action of lust, which means we're captivated by the material senses. But love for Krishna is awakened by attraction for Krishna. And that love can be executed on the spiritual platform by the devotee learning how to offer loving service to Krishna. Not service to Krishna so that I am satisfied, but service to Krishna so that Krishna is satisfied. This is love. Otherwise, who am I serving? I'm serving my mind. I'm serving my sense of touch. I'm serving my sense of vision. I want to see this beautiful girl or whatever it may be. I want to touch her, embrace her, and then everything develops. We become more and more entangled. And due to sexual connection, we become even more deeply embroiled in the connection with this material body. Therefore, the principle in civilized life is to try to decrease the intoxication. Because in the material world, we're taking intoxication, cigarettes, alcohol, so many agitations of the mind everywhere you look. Nowadays, in this modern society, the principle is to increase the disease, put fuel on the fire, instead of actually calming down the fire. The principle of modern education is to increase the fuel on the fire and keep people caught up in this whole mood of working hard just to try to enjoy the senses, instead of saying, wait a minute, what is this human life for? It's not meant for trying to satisfy the senses and become more entangled in the bodily concept of life. This human form of life is meant for bringing the senses under control and stopping them engaging in mundane activities. Rather, give them transcendental activity. So just like this example came up, Prabhupada was explaining that nowadays, if people are told you have to follow four regulative principles, you have to give up sex life, then people become horrified and they say, what sort of spiritual movement is that? But illicit sex is something which is binding in the heart. It creates a problem. And so the principle of human society is not to unrestrictedly have sex like the cats and the dogs. The principle of human society is that you restrict the engagement. At least you restrict it. One wife, one husband. There is restriction. Because if something is not good for you, then you can have but very limited restriction. Whereas the cats and the dogs, there's no restriction. Yes? There's no marriage in the cat and dog society or the hog society. It doesn't matter which family member or whoever you have sex with, but in the human society this is considered abominable. And therefore there is restriction of marriage. Similarly, gambling, it is very much restricted in the Vedic society. And in human society, the principles are there that gambling is not good. Therefore, don't do it. Don't get this artificial sense that I will cheat my destiny. Similarly, eating meat. You want to eat animal fats, then do it the civilized way. No killing of animals and creating not only bad karma, but also taking the food which has a dulling effect on the brain, which makes it impossible to understand about spiritual life. Rather, take milk products, which have a very nutritious effect on cultivating the subtle tissues of the brain, which makes it possible to understand about Krishna. Whereas we see that in this modern day society, people are so addicted to animal flesh that people have lost their power to understand anything about God. People have no brain. No brain to understand what is Krishna, what is the soul. So gambling, intoxication, meat eating and illicit sex. We're already intoxicated with this material existence. We're thinking, yeah, this is so good. And we're taking more intoxication. So the principle is to calm down the disease. If the fever is high, the principle is not to make their fever even higher, to take things which are bad for your heart condition or your material disease, but to try to reduce the fever, reduce the temperature. That's a good sign if the temperature is reducing. So there's a fever of material enjoyment in the material world. But actually the principle is to reduce the fever. So actually we get to our natural healthy condition of life. And that natural healthy condition of life is to be interested and eager to hear about Krishna and learn about our eternal relationship with Krishna and learn not only what the relationship is, but learn to act in knowledge of that relationship and to come to fully realize that relationship with Krishna. So this is the process. So there are two very different things. There is lust and love. They both have very similar appearances in one sense. Just like you can say that metal, they're both gold and iron. Well, they're both metals, yeah? But there's a big difference. Will you wear a rusty iron ring on your finger? Will you wear a rusty iron necklace around your neck? Doesn't look very good. Doesn't feel very good. But gold, on the other hand, is a completely different substance and it gives energy to the body. So the material quality of lust keeps one entangled in the material world. But the awakening of transcendental love for Krishna revives our eternal relationship with Krishna. So both metals, yes, you can say that much is there in common. But there is the rusty iron and there's the gold. Quite different in quality. So similarly, when we talk about the lusty desire of the gopis for Krishna, their mood is actually to love Krishna, to serve Krishna, to please Krishna, and have no other interest in life other than satisfying Krishna. So Srimati Radharani's prayer, it doesn't matter if you crush me by your embrace or you make me broken-hearted by not being present before me, you're completely free, my dear Lord, to do anything and everything because you're always my worshipful Lord unconditionally. Whereas in the material world, we require some sense gratification. Just like if your boss doesn't pay you, how long will you carry on working for him? It's not out of love that you work for him, and that if he pays you or doesn't pay you, it doesn't matter, it's all right. You're simply his surrendered servant. No, because I want something from, you know, I'm offering my service and I want something in exchange. This is business. But spiritual life is not a business relationship. Spiritual life is on the basis of love, that my dear Krishna, whether you kill me or maintain me, it is entirely up to you. But whatever else, I'm your eternal servant and that's enough for me. This is the difference. So as we develop our Krishna consciousness and the idea of devotional service starts to become attractive, at some point the idea of pure devotional service starts to become attractive. Anya bilasata sunyam. This is the very first verse of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. That without any tinge of sense desire for personal gain or fruitive activity or philosophical speculation for merging with the Absolute, simply the idea of rendering loving service to Krishna to satisfy his senses. This is pure devotional service. So when that starts to awaken in the heart, then gradually this develops to affection and ultimately love for Krishna. Is that okay? All right. So it's important that we understand these things very clearly, because sometimes we can forget and make mistakes in our understanding of what we're reading.
Sorry, one more question.
Excellent, good.
About this four regulative principles.
Yes.
So if someone is not following all four, or some of them, regulative principles, they will definitely have difficulty understanding spiritual knowledge, but are they likely to catch this divine mentality easily because they are either, you know, involved in intoxication or illicit sex or gambling or meat eating? Does this make them?
The principle is, if you're talking using the example of catching something, the problem is we need to understand that we're already in a diseased condition. So in the diseased condition, you can take the medicine which the doctor gives, don't do these activities and take this medicine. Restrict from these activities and take this medicine and you'll get well. But if you say, well, I'm going to carry on doing these activities, or I'm not going to take the medicine, in both cases it's going to slow your progress of recuperation. So it's not that we're going to catch something, because we've already caught it. We're already in the material world. Every one of us has caught this material body. We've caught this bhavarog, this skin disease, that this skin and bones is me. We're already in a diseased condition. So the principle is to reduce the fever. Therefore, as we associate with devotees and try to hear about Krishna, understand about Krishna, then we try to learn, yes, let me learn from these devotees. They actually are happy, they're actually understanding their life, their lives are making sense. I want my life to make sense. So let me start more and more trying to do the things that the devotees do, and that will also give me some sense in my life. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right. This is the principle. So, not that we are on the pure transcendental platform. The problem is that we're not on the pure transcendental platform. If we were on the pure transcendental platform, there'd be no need to take the medicine. Yes? Okay. Any question, Raj Prabhu? Rohit Prabhu? Jayananda Prabhu?
No problem.
Okay. So let's read a little bit more. So, are you okay to read or? No. Okay.
I'll read.
Jayananda Prabhu. Okay.
After Krishna chastised the Kalyanag in the Yamuna river by dancing on his head, the Kalyanag's wife addressed Krishna, "Dear cowherd boy, we are all only young wives of the Kalyanag, so why do we agitate our minds by sounding your flute?" Kaliya's wives were flattering Krishna so that he would spare their husband. Therefore, this is an example of upper rasa or false expression.
Yes. So this nice incident, real expression of ecstatic love for Krishna is not like simply the fluttering of the eyes and saying, oh yes, I love you, you're so nice. But actually real expression is heartfelt. But here we see that Kaliya's wives, the Nagapatnis, the incident, you may recall, was when Kaliya was being chastised by Krishna. The Nagapatnis, the wives of Kaliya, they were offering prayers to Krishna and requesting him to release their husband so that he could be spared. So in this instance, the mention is made that the Kaliya's wives were flattering Krishna so that he would spare their husband. So it wasn't a real expression of love. It was flattery, actually. Not the real thing. But still, Krishna felt satisfied that they were offering the prayers nicely. So he spared Kaliya. So, but this is an example of uparasa, or false expression. So here we're seeing that, and we'll read in the concluding words about this some more. So here we're getting the idea about these three types of dealings. This is uparasa, false expression, anurasa, an imitation, and aparasa, perverted or misrepresented manners. So, okay, so Rohit Prabhu, would you like to read a nice next paragraph, please?
One devotee said, "My dear Govinda, here is a nice flowery bush in Kailasa. I am a young girl and you are a young poetic boy. After this, what more can I say? You just consider. This is an example of uparasa caused by impudence or incongruous love."
Uh-huh. So this is an impudent expression that, "Krishna, you please come and enjoy me like this." But actually, this is... Anyway, I don't think I can say too much on this. Just we read and hear and try to understand. But basically it's not a proper instance of mellows. Just like, for example, there is some defect in the behavior. So just like it is described in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that sometimes the old ladies would also be attracted by Krishna in amorous love. But the thing is that the old ladies, they're not expert in these loving dealings. And so there is a mixture. Although the expression is there of love for Krishna, still it's not a proper expression. It's an improper expression. It's described that one elderly cowherd lady, she was taking fruits and propping up her breasts to make her look young, and casting amorous glances towards Krishna. And, you know, it was very funny, because it was very inappropriate. Still, it was an attraction towards Krishna, but it was not a proper dealing of relationship of mellows. Do we have anyone else on board? Who is on board? Is that Leela?
Leela, yeah.
Leela, okay. Hare Krishna, Leela. So... Okay. Yeah, if you've got any questions, Leela, please feel free to ask. No problem. So anyway, these are improper expressions, because actually the pure loving dealing with Krishna is in one of these five primary mellows: neutrality, servitorship, parental love, friendship, or conjugal love. And in this way, the dealings are going on in their pure form. So, anyway, let's have a look at this next example. Would you like to read on, Ashok Prabhu,
yeah,
please?
when Narada Muni was passing through Vrindavan, he came to the Pandiravan forest and saw in one of the trees the famous parrot couple that always accompanies Lord Krishna. The couple was imitating some discussion they had heard upon the Vedanta philosophy, and thus was seemingly arguing upon various philosophical points. Upon seeing this, Narada Muni was struck with wonder, and he began to stare without moving his eyelids. This is an example of anuras or imitation.
So this is a different experience. The couple was imitating some discussion. You may be interested to know that there is this couple of parrots who follow Radha and Krishna around in Vrindavan. And the example here is they're imitating the conversation that they've heard by these great sages discussing Vedanta philosophy. So Narada Muni is struck with wonder about hearing how these parrots are having this incredibly deep philosophical discussion of Vedanta philosophy. So therefore he's very much struck with wonder, because actually they're imitating the rasa. So it's not actually the real rasa, they're actually very attached to Krishna, but they're in this imitation role play. They're discussing Vedanta philosophy. So Narada Muni was very much struck with wonder, experiencing this. What are these two parrots saying? Really high level philosophical talks. You don't expect to hear the parrots doing this. But anyway. Any comment or question is there? Here comes the cavalry. Hare Krishna, Rasika. Good. Okay. So, all right. Rasika, would you like to take my lecture of devotion so you can read? We're actually only two paragraphs away from the end of the last chapter, in fact. So we're shockingly getting close to the position where we're going to be. Yeah, when Krishna was fleeing from the battlefield. That's the one. Would you like to read that paragraph for us, please?
You were a rescue. She just come.
Sorry?
She just come. You were a rescue.
Okay. So, top of page 399, perverted expression of mallows.
When Krishna was fleeing from the battlefield from a distant place, Jarasandha was watching him and with restless eyes and was feeling very proud. Being thus puffed up with his conquest, he was repeatedly laughing. This is an example of a parsa.
Okay, so this is the last example here. This is, if you see on the previous page, 397, aparasa is described as perverted or misrepresented mallows. So it cannot actually be in loving relationship with Krishna, because he's actually laughing at Krishna, thinking that Krishna, he's such a rascal. He's actually Jarasandha, he's a demon. So he cannot actually have rasa with Krishna. And although he is laughing at Krishna, then is hasya rasa. It's actually a perverted reflection. This is described as misrepresented mala. It's not real rasa with Krishna. Because it's actually, he's a demon, so he cannot have actually rasa with Krishna. Rasa with Krishna is only exhibited with Krishna's devotees. But if a devotee sees that this demon is laughing at Krishna, but he's such a fool, because he really doesn't understand who Krishna is, and he starts laughing at this demon's nonsense, this is rasa. This is actually real laughing rasa, because he's seeing that this foolish rascal, he doesn't know who Krishna is. it's got no difference. So when a demon is laughing at Krishna, it's actually not a relationship with Krishna. But this situation when a devotee is seeing this foolishness, then he's in rasa with Krishna, in loving dealings with Krishna. Is that okay? So this is why this last example, mostly we've been concentrating on uparasa, and then there was the example of Narada Muni and the parrots, which was anurasa, which is the second class, which is an imitation, and finally this uparasa, perverted or misrepresented mallows. So anyway, let's read Jayananda Prabhu, would you like to read the concluding paragraph and statement, please?
Everything in connection with Krishna is called aesthetic devotional love, although it may be exhibited in different ways, sometimes in right order and sometimes with parotid reflections. According to the opinion of all expert devotees, anything that will rouse aesthetic love for Krishna is to be taken as an impetuous for transcendental mellows. Thus, in the Bhaktivinoda summary study of Srila Rupa, Srila Bhakti Rasamrita Sito by Srila Rupa Goswami.
Thank you. So this is the point, that everything in connection with Krishna is called ecstatic devotional love, although it may be exhibited in different ways. So just like we see that things are related with Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, we've been reading the names of all these great generals on the battlefield. What have they got to do with Krishna? Well, they've got a lot to do with Krishna, because ultimately Krishna is going to kill them all and give them their spiritual bodies. So therefore we patiently hear about all these wonderful situations that are taking place on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, because they're connected to Krishna. Therefore they are tadiya, they're related to Krishna. It's part of Krishna's pastimes, his paraphernalia. Now, the idea is that Srila Rupa Goswami is expressing here that everything in connection with Krishna is called ecstatic devotional love, although it may be exhibited in different ways. It may be exhibited in real rasa, or it may be exhibited even through rasabhasa, through a contradictory way, like we're discussing these three ways. This is by the false expression, or by imitation, or by perverted or misrepresented mellows of love. So sometimes it's in the right order, and sometimes it's in a perverted reflection. But the point that Srila Rupa Goswami makes in his concluding statement, according to the opinion of all expert devotees, anything that will arouse ecstatic love for Krishna is to be taken as an impetus for transcendental mellow. It may or may not be directly a transcendental mellow, but if it's if it actually helps arouse ecstatic love for Krishna, then it's considered an impetus towards developing that mellow of loving dealing with Krishna. So, just like we see sometimes things happen, and they may appear sometimes to be a little unpleasant. Sometimes it happens that, for example, supposing the cook at the Sunday feast prepares something and they put something, so supposing they burn the rice. Yeah? So that's fortunately a very rare occurrence. But we may understand that if the rice has got a little burned, we can still understand so many things about that to help us remember Krishna. That, oh, if ever I was in that situation, I would have to be very careful that I didn't upset Krishna by offering him burnt rice. Or, for example, one may take it's little burnt, but still, this is Krishna's mercy. So let me just take the prasad and remember this is Krishna's mercy coming to me in this form. So different ways, because we should not criticize Krishna prasadam. It's not salty enough, or oh, it's too much salt, or so many things, or too hot, or too chilly, or whatever it is, or no taste, or whatever it may be. We shouldn't criticize Krishna Prasadam, because in the end it's Krishna Prasadam, it's Krishna's mercy. So even some apparently contradictory thing may sometimes appear at first glance to be unhelpful, you know, but actually we can learn from it and still see everything in relationship with Krishna. Jayananda Prabhu, you wanted to make a point here.
No,
Prabhu. No? Am I misreading your body language?
No, I was not. I don't read.
Okay. Alright, so has anybody got any questions or comments about what we've been reading?
Okay,
Prabhu.
Last one question to me. What was Srila Prabhupada's mood of service? What trust was he?
That I have no access to understanding that. The only thing I can understand is that Srila Prabhupada is the most wonderful devotee, and I'm just trying to convince my mind and senses to become his servant. So beyond that, I'm totally unqualified to speak.
So is everybody else, you know. So are we.
What can I say? But I can tell you this one thing that I was listening to today. Prabhupada was explaining. I was reading it today in Prabhupada's quotes. He was saying that the spiritual master, his job is to chastise the disciple. Just like Chanakya Pandit, he gives the principle that if you have a son or a disciple, you don't simply pat them. Because if you pat them, then they'll just become nonsense. But the spiritual master's job is to find out the fault in his son or his disciple so that he becomes very first class, actually. This is the point. If you simply praise, then actually that person will never improve. But the spiritual master's job is always to chastise and find out the fault. And in that way, the disciple makes progress. The disciple or the son becomes very well trained and very, very good. Just like Krishna, when Arjun surrendered to him as his disciple, he said, "Now I'm your disciple, I surrender to you. Please instruct me." Krishna's first business, chastise him. Arjun, you're speaking learned words, but you're not a pandit, you're a fool. First business, you know, chastise the disciple. And Krishna tells Arjuna off in so many different ways, because that's the role of the spiritual master, to correct the disciple. Because the situation is that we're in a diseased condition. We're in an incorrect situation. So we have to become corrected. So Prabhupada was explaining like that. And therefore he explained that actually the spiritual master, when he chastises the disciple, the disciple takes this as mercy. And he gave the example of one time when he was sitting, listening to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, his spiritual master. And one elderly man, he was also there, sitting, and he wanted to discuss something with Prabhupada. Prabhupada was sitting, listening, and this elderly man, he started saying something to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was kind of obliged to answer him. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati got very, very angry with him. And he chastised this man who was giving 60 rupees a month to the temple, which obviously in those days was a lot of money. And he says, "What is this? You think that by your 60 rupees you have purchased us, that now you can do whatever you like?" And Prabhupada explained that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, he would use very strong language. He would call someone a damn fool and a rascal and a nonsense. He would chastise them very, very heavily. And the devotee would take it. "This is very good. I'm being corrected. I'm being chastised by my spiritual master. This is good for me." So this is actually the principle of developing in spiritual life. We have to, if we're actually serious in our spiritual life, then we have to learn to take the correction that we get from the spiritual master not think that, you know, I'm great, I'm fine, everybody else is nonsense, but I'm fine. No, we have to learn to take correction, because the problem is that we are incorrect. And the spiritual master's job, his service to the disciple, is to correct the disciple and make him correct, make him nicely trained, make him actually proper, pukka disciple and servant. Is that okay? Hare Krishna. So let's just read a couple of things. We've got concluding words and some things about the author. So, Rohit Prabhu, would you like to read us this section called Concluding Words, please, Prabhu?
Concluding Words. Srila Rupa Goswami concludes by saying that Bhakti Rasamata Siddhu is very difficult for ordinary men to understand. Yet he hopes that Lord Krishna, the Eternal Supreme Personality of Godhead, will be pleased with his presentation of this book. By rough calculation, it is estimated that Srila Rupa Goswami finished Sri Bhakti Rasamata Siddhu in Kukula, Vrindavan in the year 1552. While physically present, Srila Rupa Goswami was living in different parts of Vrindavan, and his headquarters were in the temple of Radha Damora in the present city of Vrindavan, the place of Rupa Goswami Bhajana execution of devotional service is commemorated still. There are two different tomb-like structures in the Radha Damora temple. One structure is called this place of Bhajana, and the other is the body is entombed. Behind this very tomb I have my place of Bhajana. But since 1965 I have been away. The place, however, is being taken care of by my disciples. By Krishna's will, I am now residing in Los Angeles Temple of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. This purport is finished today, the 30th of June, 1969.
Mm. Very nice. So this is the situation. Prabhupada would stay at the Radha Damodar Temple, and his place, his room, would look out on the Samadhi tomb of Srila Rupa Goswami. This was a great inspiration for Srila Prabhupada. And Rupa Goswami's principle, jnana vairagya ucchate, that it is not that we renounce, but with knowledge, we develop knowledge and detachment. And with knowledge and detachment, we engage practically in devotional service. So although Srila Prabhupada left his residence, which is still there, still kept for him at the Radha Damodar Temple in Sri Vrindavan Dham.
Still today?
Oh, still today, yes. Prabhupada's instructions to his disciples that you keep this room for me. You just keep it exactly the way it is. Mahanidhi Swami and different devotees would take it in turns to reside there at the Radha Damodar Temple and keep Prabhupada's rooms intact. They're still there. You can still visit Prabhupada's room there where he started writing this nectar of devotion. And his meditation was always on this wonderful Srila Rupa Goswami trying to represent this very important book for the modern day world. Following in the line of Srila Jiva Goswami, who also wrote a commentary on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and others who have written wonderful commentaries on this same book, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But Srila Prabhupada is presenting this. Following in the line of Srila Rupa Goswami, he went around the world to present Krishna consciousness on the order of his spiritual master. And in this way, he's explaining that when he was finishing this book, that he's residing at the Los Angeles Temple. This is Srila Rupa Goswami's request. It was Lord Chaitanya's desire that Krishna consciousness be spread all over the world. So following on the orders, the instructions given to Rupa Goswami by Lord Chaitanya, we're also following in this same line. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj, he was also following it. It was Bhaktivinoda Thakur's desire to spread these books of the Goswamis in the Western countries so that people can understand what is Radha and Krishna. Because without understanding the instructions of these six Goswamis, no one can understand what is Radha and Krishna. Even we have Radha Krishna in our temples, Radha Krishna deities. Actually, this is not Radha Krishna worship. This is Lakshmi Narayan worship. Radha Krishna worship can only be carried out by persons who are fully liberated souls. So Prabhupada explains that actually we are worshipping Lakshmi Narayan in a mood of awe and reverence. That's why everything has to be done very properly, very precisely, in that mood of awe and reverence, not half-heartedly or haphazardly. Very correctly, punctually, everything done very nicely. And then one day, by following the instructions and the guidance of these six Goswamis, Prabhupada explains, then one day we will come to understand what is Radha and Krishna, what is actually the worship of Radha and Krishna. But in these forms of Radha and Krishna, they accept our service as Lakshmi Narayan. But actually, Radha Krishna worship is not cheap. If we think that we're worshipping Radha and Krishna, we're mistaken, actually. Because this is how the Sahajiyas do it. They take it, everything is very cheap. They take it that, yes, I don't even need Bhagavad Gita, because this is simply about Krishna's fighting activities, but I'm only interested in Radha Krishna's loving dealings with the gopis. So this is nonsense mentality. By this mentality, one cannot even begin to approach what is the platform of Radha and Krishna's worship. But when we try to understand the instructions left by the six Goswamis, when we become eager to understand the instructions left by the six Goswamis, then we'll be able to understand what are the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, who they are. So anyway, this is a very nice moment. And I think we could just briefly read through this last, very last part in the appendix about the author, which would help us appreciate more of what Prabhupada has actually given. So let's take it in turns to read paragraphs on this from page 405. Ashok Prabhu, could you read us a couple of paragraphs, please?
Yes. His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada appeared in this world in 1896 in Kolkata, India. He first met his spiritual master Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami in Kolkata in 1922. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, a prominent religious scholar and the founder of 64 Gaudiya Mathas Vedic Institutes, liked this educated young man and convinced him to dedicate his life to teaching Vedic knowledge. Srila Prabhupada became his student, and 11 years later, 1933, at Allahabad, he became his formally initiated disciple. At their first meeting in 1922, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur requested Srila Prabhupada to broadcast Vedic knowledge through the English language. In the years that followed, Srila Prabhupada wrote a commentary on Bhagavad Gita, assisted the Gaudiya Matha in its work, and in 1944, without assistance, started Back to Godhead, an English fortnightly magazine, edited it, typed the manuscripts, and checked the Gali proofs. He even distributed the individual copies and struggled to maintain the publication. Once begun, the magazine never stopped. It is now being continued by his disciples in the West and is published in over 30 languages.
Mm. You would like to read on, Rasika, please?
Recognizing Srila Prabhupada's philosophical learning and devotion, the Gaudiya Vaishnava Society honored him in 1947. With the title Bhaktivedanta. In 1950, at the age of 54, Srila Prabhupada retired from married life, adopting the Vanaprastha retired in order to devote more time to his studies and writing. Srila Prabhupada travelled to the holy city of Vrindavan, where he lived in a very humble circumstances in the historic medieval temple of Radha Damodar. There he engaged for several years in deep study and writing. He accepted the renounced order of life, sannyas, in 1959. At Radha Damodar, Srila
Prabhupada.
At Radha Damodar, Srila Master subsequently, His Divine Grace wrote more than 60 volumes of authoritative translation.
Okay, you've got some missed out in your volume, I don't know how. So, if you could carry on, please.
At Radha Damodar, Srila Prabhupada began work on his life's masterpiece, a multi-volume translation of and commentary on the 18,000 words Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavat Purana. He also wrote Easy Journey to Other Planets. After publishing three volumes of Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada came to the United States in 1965 to fulfill the mission of his spiritual master. Subsequently, His Divine Grace wrote more than 60 volumes of authoritative translations, commentaries, and summary studies of the philosophical and religious classics of India. In 1965, when he first arrived by freighter in New York City, Srila Prabhupada was practically penniless. It was after almost a year of great difficulty that he established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness in July of 1966. Before his passing away on November 14, 1977, he guided the society and saw it grow to a worldwide confederation of more than 100 ashramas, schools, temples, institutes, and farm communities. Shall I continue, Prabhu?
Maybe Rohit Prabhu, you could read a little bit for us, please.
In 1968, Srila Prabhupada created New Vrindavan, an experimental Vedic community in the hills of West Virginia. Inspired by the success of New Vrindavan, now a thriving farm community of more than 2,000 acres, his students have since founded several similar communities in the United States and abroad. In 1972, His Divine Grace introduced the Vedic system of primary and secondary education in the West by founding the Gurukula School in Dallas, Texas. Since then, under his supervision, his disciples have established children's schools throughout the United States and the rest of the world, with the principal educational center for now located in Vrindavana, India. Sri Prabhupada also inspired the construction of several large international cultural centers in India. The center of Siddharma Mayapur in West Bengal is a site for a planned spiritual city, an ambitious project of which constructions will extend over the next decade. In Vrindavana, India is the magnificent Krishna Balarama Temple, an international guest house. There is also a major cultural and educational center in Bombay. Other centers are planned in a dozen other important locations on the Indian subcontinent.
Ashok Prabhu, would you like to read the last couple of paragraphs for us, please?
Srila Prabhupada's most significant contribution, however, is this book, highly respected by the academic community for their authoritativeness, depth, and clarity. They are used as standard textbook in numerous college courses. His writings have been translated into over 30 languages. The Bhaktivedanta Book Trust established in 1972 exclusively to publish the works of His Divine Grace, has thus become the world's largest publisher of the books in the field of Indian religion and philosophy. In just 12 years, in spite of his advanced age, Srila Prabhupada circled the globe 14 times on a lecture tours that took him took him to six continents. In spite of such a vigorous schedule, Srila Prabhupada continued to write prolifically. His writings constitute a veritable library of Vedic philosophy, religion, literature and culture.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai. There's one thing I'd like to share with you. Two things I'd like to briefly share with you. One is, you see, that when Prabhupada came to the West, it wasn't all laid out for him. He had intense struggle for a year in a foreign country with no money to actually try and establish the Krishna consciousness movement, never having been to the West before. And then people started taking his work seriously. It took a long time to get this established, this Krishna consciousness movement. So we can take advantage of the fact that Prabhupada put so much hard effort into trying to establish Krishna consciousness very firmly. And one of the techniques he used was, you see, sometimes if you look at Bhagavad Gita, you see there are book reviews by great scholars and eminent persons, and they still want to get book reviews by modern day eminent people. And I'd just like to share this with you, because this came through just today, about how Prabhupada liked getting these book reviews, because it encouraged people to take Krishna consciousness very seriously. And this is a quote from Hari Suri's Transcendental Diary. Very interesting quote, in actual fact. So this is actually in his book. After settling in, Hridayananda Maharaj came to Prabhupada's room to give an update on his preaching activities. He read him a book review written by an Indian professor in Mexico, Dr. Vajpayee. The review stated that Prabhupada's books are important because, quote, they expose the terrible cheating of bogus swamis. Prabhupada was so pleased to hear this assertion that he started in his seat. He was excited and happy that such a learned man was able to perceive how true Vedic knowledge is being spoiled by misrepresentation. This is required, he said. He requested that 100,000 copies of the review should be made. He wants them distributed throughout India, especially Bombay and Madras, where there is so much propaganda from these bogus gurus and yogis. This is my intention, he said, to stop the so-called swamis and yogis from cheating the public. So this is definitely Srila Prabhupada's mood. If you want to know what is Srila Prabhupada's mood of devotional service, that is Prabhupada's mood. How to benefit everyone, how to educate people to know what is the science of Krishna, so they will be, may not be misled by all these rascal cheaters and bogus gurus and rascals everywhere. Is that okay?
Yeah.
And if we try to follow in Srila Prabhupada's mood, that will be a credit for us. Trying to follow in Srila Prabhupada's footsteps at his lotus feet. Any questions or comments? No? Then let us accept that we've now read through the entire Nectar of Devotion. We haven't started the index. We can do that next week. But yes. Alternatively, we can start again at the beginning of Nectar of Devotion next week, if that's all right. So anybody who would like to come in from the beginning to really get the ground-up understanding of Nectar of Devotion, that's a very good opportunity and time to do it. It's taken us some years, actually, to read steadily through this book. But it's very wonderful that Prabhupada has given us this chance to understand this amazing teaching by Srila Rupa Goswami. So I thank you all very much indeed for your patience and eagerness to hear and try to understand. and tolerating me throughout. So I can only say, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, nitai gaur premanandi, hari bol. Krishna Padaya, Krishna Pastaya Bhutale, Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamani, Namaste Saraswati Devi, Gauravani Pacharani, Nivisesha Sanyavadi Pasti Jade Shatari. So we have 5 minutes kirtan, and then we have a little prasad for everyone. Thank you all very much. Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.